Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock and time for the KBOO Food Show with the KBOO Food Collective. Topics today include benefits of a vegetarian diet and a program to get immigrants and refugees into farming in the Northwest. At 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, an Iraqi feminist comments on this weekend's vote on the proposed constitution and an interview with author and social critic Barbara Ehrenreich. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Some food in my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away, just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good. 'Cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dying their throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat.
Good morning. Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm Marlise.
And I'm Kate.
And I'm Bruce.
Thank you for joining us this morning. We have Bruce has a report about an effort to assist refugees and immigrants to become farmers in Northwest Oregon. We'll be speaking with Phil Howard, who will be speaking about the corporatization of organics. Plus, we'll be talking about crepes and cheese. And so our first report is with Bruce, with Mercy Corps and refugee immigrants and farmers.
The Portland area receives its share of refugees and immigrants from various places. Some of these people get into the food industry, usually as low-wage employees of farmers or food processors. But some of those who were farmers in their homeland, and even some others who don't have a background in agriculture, may want to get involved in growing food to feed themselves or to profit. Is it possible? Recently, Mercy Corps Northwest, which is most widely known as a relief agency, commissioned a study of this issue. Mercy Corps' director, John Haynes, says they had an idea that refugees and immigrants might succeed if they followed certain guidelines.
Well, we felt there was an opportunity based on what we know about the emerging and evolving regional food economy that involves smaller, locally produced, locally buying farmers market growth and growth in healthy, locally produced, sustainably harvested food products, that there's an opportunity to extend to particularly to refugee and immigrant populations to get involved in and earn money, build assets, and integrate into the community via food.
Haynes says that for those who want to get into farming, it could be a good thing.
It's about them building family assets, not just income, but family assets. And the other thing that is sort of maybe a softer secondary benefit, but definitely important, is just how it's a force of integration and pride for the children, youth, the whole family can get involved. And, once they're building relationships, whether it's at a farmer's market or a couple of restaurants, they learn more about the community learns more about them, and they become a deeper involved participant. So food is a hugely integrative force, and we're trying to use the market potential to also build people's opportunity to learn and grow and build a life in a new place.
Farming, at least on a small scale, may be a dying way of life elsewhere in the U.S., but in Western Oregon, the trend is in the other direction, according to Haynes.
The number of farms is increasing, smaller farms, micro farms, as opposed to larger ones. So the growth in farms, I don't have the figures in front of me, but from 1 to 9 acres has grown fairly significantly, and then those from 10 to 50 acres, which are also still, you know, pretty small farms, have grown in numbers, which is completely contrary to those kind of circumstances elsewhere in the country.
Yes, but even 5 or 10 acres, is that enough land for a person or a family to earn a living?
Depends on what they're growing, how they grow it, and what their markets are, you know, and how well they add value to what they're growing. You know, so in other words, if they're doing it without toxins, pesticides, if they're growing organically, and they're able to sell through a couple different market channels that capture a premium that they deserve because of their practices, then yes, some people can make a living off smaller plots of land, under 5 acres even. To grow organically, they can capture a premium at any number of restaurants that are willing to buy directly from farmers through, you know, a network of the Farmer Chef Connection and others. We wanted to try to extend this to those restaurants that aren't necessarily the higher-end restaurants, but those that are more mainstream, that serve ethnic markets, and have them buy locally and buy better quality organic produce.
Let's go back a step to acquiring land. Even if you only want 5 acres, that would be the smallest farm that we've mentioned in our conversation so far. 5 acres in the northern Willamette Valley, can the typical immigrant afford that?
No, probably not. So what we're anticipating could be a progression of somebody's business development in farming would be to start even as small as an urban garden and small plots, 50 by 100 foot plots, on a farm that we had been working with this year. So get people sort of engaged in the process of growing, so it isn't so much at a scale which is overwhelming and impractical for them, but a way to get engaged in how to grow, what to grow, and how to market it, and then take that small scale and build it up over time through first renting, doing lease-to-own lease options, and some other kind of mechanisms to get people access to the land without necessarily owning it until they've got the farming capacity and the income experience and markets to support the obligation of owning the land.
The study on immigrants entering farming was written for Mercy Corps by Cascadia Planners. Jemison Cavallero, one of the researchers, tells of one obstacle to those who would want to buy a small plot of land.
There's a very, very dominant paradigm when you talk about receiving loans, especially. And if you're going to attempt to find a low-interest loan from the Federal Farm Service Agency, you might struggle if you're an organic farmer, period. You're definitely going to have to create a strong case if you want to try to farm on an acreage smaller than, let's say, 100 mm-hmm. acres. So 5 acres from a study done in North Carolina seems to be what the Farm Service Agency is willing to explore and fund.
Another obstacle is simply that immigrants don't know that farming is an economic option for them. Researcher Mauricio Leclerc of Cascadia Planners explains.
There are some who farm, there are others who farm and no longer do so, but a lot of them don't really know that farming is an option, and that's one of the exciting things about the document, that we would like to convey to them that given their experience back home, because many of them are farmers, this is a viable alternative today, and it turns out that many of them were farmers, and they were excited about the possibilities, and we had a great discussion about it. You know, what can grow here? What did you grow back home that you could grow here? But many did not anticipate coming to the United States to keep doing what they were doing back home. They're thinking of the American dream, or in other terms, especially living in a large metropolitan region.
Like Haynes, Leclerc says that even if a family just grows enough food for itself, that can be considered a success.
Farming could be a way to supplement income. You don't have to go full-time into farming, but just it will help you supplement income and also give you food security, which is, you know, as we cable listeners must know, it's a big issue in Oregon.
Haynes met recently with others who are active in helping refugees and immigrants grow food, and he says his colleagues reminded him of the high level of awareness among the public here on issues such as local production and sustainability.
The one thing Portland has in real abundance that everybody salivates over is just that we have a pretty extraordinarily involved caring community when it comes to food, and people really do value local, locally produced, healthy, organic food and are willing to pay for it. And, that opportunity doesn't translate as consistently elsewhere in the country. So we've got a real opportunity to do this. The challenge we're finding is finding the entrepreneurs that are, you know, that are committed to what it takes to build a farm-related growing enterprise.
Mercy Corps Northwest did sponsor a pilot project this summer at Sanger Farm in Portland, where several women from Southeast Asia grew food on a subsistence level. But as he said, immigrants who would grow food as a business are a little hard to find so far. On the positive side, he said quite a few organizations and government agencies have shown some interest.
Thank you, Bruce, and for that piece. And thank you to all of your interviewees. We now have Phil Howard on the telephone, and he is a PhD with the UC of Santa Cruz. Phil, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for joining the Food Show with me and Kate and Bruce.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Phil, you've been researching the topic of the corporatization of organic foods for quite a few years. How many years?
About 3 years.
Okay. And what changes have you seen in, and what sort of developments have you seen?
Well, I kind of got into this a little bit after this peaked, but basically in the late 90s, after the USDA announced the national organic standards, a number of large corporations began to buy some smaller companies that were involved in organic food production. So there was this huge wave of acquisitions, peaked around 1999, but it's still going on.
And what makes organic food so attractive to larger corporations?
One of the reasons is that sales of organic foods have been increasing at least 20% a year since 1990. And although the food industry is typically very profitable, sales growth is usually pretty slow. I mean, there's only so much we can eat. But because organic foods are so popular and successful, they really saw a market that they wanted to get into.
So there are more people farming organic foods and more people buying it, right?
Yeah.
And so what happens with smaller farmers when a big corporation approaches them or a smaller company? What makes that an attractive transaction?
Well, with the food processing companies, some of these organic brands that you see in the natural food store and the supermarket, what's attractive is, you know, since World War II, food companies have really been into building brands. And so they really saw an opportunity to take over the brand image that some of these smaller companies had built up when organic was a very young industry. And they really paid huge prices. The prices they paid for these companies were a lot more than they would be worth according to Wall Street. And what they were paying for was this brand image.
So for them to look better in their company, they're not necessarily interested in the philosophy behind it.
You could make that argument. And, and one of the things you'll see is that on the food packages, you won't see any evidence that these big corporations own organic brands.
Can you give us some examples?
An example would be General Mills, which bought Cascadian Farm in Muirland, see the big General Mills symbol on those packages, you just see Cascadian Farm.
Mm-hmm. And what are some other examples?
Another example is a huge dairy conglomerate called Dean, which purchased Horizon Organic Milk and then purchased Silk Soy Milk and White Wave Tofu. Some other, M&M Mars purchased Seeds of Change, and Kellogg owns Kashi and Morningstar Farms and Natural Touch.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Howard. Phil. This is Kate here. Do you know if when a larger company purchases a smaller label like that, does the quality of the product change?
I think it depends. I mean, for the example of M&M Mars, they've been pretty hands-off about their acquisition of Seeds of Change. But with Bean, they've been much more hands-on. For example, they moved White Wave Silk's headquarters to Boulder, where Horizon Organic already was, and they've greatly increased the amount of imported soybeans that they're using in the soy milk.
And what about the processing? Are they processing on any equipment that their regular labels are processed on?
I'm not sure. I mean, usually the General Mills, Cascadian Farms has greatly expanded their production. So, you know, they're importing produce from China, for example, whereas before, you know, in the 70s, it was a very, very small-scale operation in Washington State.
So who is certifying that it's organic? Certainly Washington State's not certifying a Chinese product as organic.
Yeah, there are about almost half of the certifiers for the USDA standards are based in other countries. So usually the product will list who the certifier is, and it's probably not going to be Oregon Tilth.
And I was wondering, too, you had talked about some of the seeds that had been bought up by larger corporations and what happened to seed stocks that have affected also the agriculture of organics.
Yeah, for example, Monsanto earlier this year acquired Seminis, which was a huge multinational seed conglomerate, which sells 40% of the fruit and vegetable seeds in the United States. And even if you're an organic grower, if you buy through an independent seed company like Fedco, they get a lot of their seeds from Seminis. So it's a situation where there's a lot more power concentrated in the hands of a giant corporation.
And what happens with the seed stocks that aren't, or the seeds that aren't being used, or that they don't want anymore? Do you know?
Yeah, one of the things Seminis did a year or two ago was that, you know, it cost a lot of money to acquire all these seed companies. The seed companies used to be, you know, very small operations in the 1970s, and they've just gotten bigger and bigger. And so to pay for all these acquisitions, Seminis decides to dump about a third of its line of seeds, of fruits and vegetable seeds. So you can't even buy those seeds anymore.
And by dumping, does that mean they destroyed it, or they just put it in a warehouse somewhere, or is it completely unavailable anymore?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. I know mm-hmm. they're not selling them.
What about Walmart and some of the bigger grocery or store chains that are going to that have really been interested in looking into organics? How does that affect the market?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting example of how mainstream organic has become, is that Walmart is probably the largest seller of organic foods in the United States. And Walmart's notorious for putting a lot of pressure on its suppliers to reduce prices as much as possible. So what's happening is the farmers who grow organic foods for Walmart are going to get very, very low prices.
In comparison to other farmers that stick with smaller chains?
Yeah.
And you were talking about also some of the recent moves to weaken the standards for organics in connection with this theme. Please tell us a little bit more about that.
Recently, the Organic Trade Association was pushing a rider on the Agricultural Appropriations Bill, which would create some loopholes in the national organic standards. For example, it would allow synthetic ingredients in organic foods, processed foods, and it could allow treating young dairy cows with antibiotics a year before they're certified as organic. And there are a number of companies that signed on to this, and there are a lot of the big names that you see taking over organic, like General Mills, Kraft, Dole, Dean. And there are a lot of consumers and some smaller organic food companies that are opposed to this effort. And they want, and for example, Consumers Union, the publishers of Consumer Reports, they did a poll and they found that 85% of people don't expect foods that are labeled organic to contain artificial ingredients. But currently a lot of them do. And your Organic Trade Association wants to make sure that they can continue to do that and actually increase the number of synthetic ingredients that they have in organic food.
And who makes up the Organic Trade Association and with whom are they speaking in order to get to get this through?
Well, they have a large membership, and you would see a lot of smaller companies in addition to these large companies. But it seems like the Organic Trade Association is beginning to speak more for those larger companies. For example, one of their members is Eden Foods, which is a pretty large-scale organic foods company that has resisted being taken over by corporations, and they are opposed to this effort, even though they are a member of the Organic Trade Association.
Mm-hmm. And what are some other companies that are for it?
Besides the ones I mentioned, there are a couple of surprisingly independent companies that have resisted being taken over that are for it, and these are Nature's Path and Organic Valley, which is a cooperative.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of support do they get in the political arena?
Well, I think when you've got General Mills and Kraft lobbyists working for this, it's going to be tough to beat. But I think consumers have been organized around this issue. They don't want to see their organic standards weakened. And so more than 250,000 letters have been generated by groups like the Organic Consumers Association and the Center for Food Safety to oppose this rider.
And we will mention that again, the Organic Consumers Association, who are on the web, which was the other one? Center for Food Safety. Do they have a format of letters or something that you can hook into and send off?
Yeah, they both do. So you could go to organicconsumers.org or centerforfoodsafety.org.
And where do the letters go, and how have they been effective in changing?
The letters would go to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
They would figure out which person sent it to based on your zip code.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with that level of letters being generated, it does make a difference. If it was just three or four people writing a letter versus General Mills lobbyists, I don't think there'd be much reason to be optimistic. But with this level of public involvement in the issue, I think it's going to be very tough for Congress to do what the Organic Trade Association wants.
And I've read about previous efforts to do similar things, that the public response has been so overwhelming that there was no way to ignore the public response.
Right.
And we were also now, how does this corporatization affect the beef industry? The smaller, is it pretty much the similar along across the board of the various farmers and the various industries?
It depends on industry. For example, Organic Valley sells beef, and in the last year they've been importing beef from Australia because they can get it for cheaper prices than they can from U.S. growers.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of companies are moving to import produce from other countries. What does that mean for the consumer, for us, and how does that benefit or not?
Well, unfortunately, we don't always know. Congress passed country of origin labeling legislation, but the USDA has kind of dragging its feet on implementing it. So right now, the food doesn't have to be labeled. Some of the companies do label, like Cascadian Farms says on its label that some of the vegetables are from China or South America, but they don't have to do that. So we don't always know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other impact is that more and more of our food is being imported from other countries. The value of food imports will soon be higher than food exports, which means we're going to be importing more food than we're growing in our own country. And, you know, this has a big impact on farmers in the U.S. I mean, they can't compete with the prices of farmers growing in China, and so it's harder for them to stay in business, which means as fuel prices go up or, you know, in emergencies, we're not going to have local growers to supply us if they can't stay in business.
Right. And we will talk more about that. Unfortunately, Phil, we've run out of time. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, and we will repeat the the web addresses, and then also you mentioned one really quick agriculture accountability.
Yeah, agricultureaccountability.org.
Okay.
And also, if you want to see the corporate takeover visually, I have a chart.
Okay.
And the easiest way to find that is to go to a search engine and type corporate organic chart.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we have another guest. He's Dave of Dave's Bread. As listeners probably know, I go to the Portland Downtown Farmers Market almost every week. And this summer, Dave appeared. I'm always willing to try a new bread, and I tried his, and I liked it. So let's talk to Dave about how he got into baking. Hello, Dave.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm doing real well. I'm real busy. I like it.
Okay. I know we caught you in the bakery. You just started selling bread with your own name on it really in the last couple of months, but I think you've got a longer connection with baking, right?
I sure do.
Tell us.
Well, my dad, his name was Jim Dahl. He and my mother founded Nature Bake back in 1955 or so. It was 55. And so it's 50 years ago. My dad's dead now. They didn't call it Nature Bake back then, by the way. It's gone through a couple of different names. And myself grew up baking bread, you know, and kind of took it for granted, kind of didn't really see it as something I wanted to do. And at some point, I started doing drugs and became a pretty serious criminal.
Okay, Dave, I want you to continue on that, but I'm going to ask you to back away from your phone about 1 inch further.
Sure, okay.
Okay, that sounds better.
All right.
Okay, so you got into drugs other than yeast. Tell us.
Yeah. Well, I experimented around with them when I was younger. Marijuana and such, like pretty much everybody, I guess. And the problem was I had issues that were pretty serious myself, and it wasn't until I was like 22 or so I discovered methamphetamine, and it just totally, I saw it as my personal savior, like, and it just changed my life, and I stopped caring about everything. All the things that were bothering me before just stopped happening,
mm-hmm.
Stopped being an issue.
Okay, and you served some hard time.
Yeah, I did approximately 15 years out of the last 20 years of my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, this last time I did 88 months on assault and delivery, combined charges. And when I got out, or before I got out, I realized I needed to do something different. You know, it was quite a... Early on, I was very depressed for the first 2 or 3 years. I figured my life was over, and I knew I had to do something. I got to the point where I finally, you know, saw that there was something I could do. And, my whole life started just changing around. The way I started thinking about things and what I used to do and stuff, I actually started feeling like I was being held accountable for what I did. And
mm-hmm.
I didn't blame anybody anymore. I stopped blaming everybody else, and that was a big change for me. I got out with the idea of making some good bread and other things too, other baked goods.
Did you work in the kitchen in the prison?
Very little. You know, I worked some in the kitchen. I worked in the bakery for a little while. Wasn't really into it there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not really what I'm trying to do. I was working in a prison bakery, but and not to say anything wrong with prison bakeries, but I did work as a drafter. I became a drafter.
Okay.
And that really helped me along with my thought processes.
So, Dave, Kate here. I have some experience being a commercial baker as well, and I know exactly how therapeutic it can be to take a blob of dough and slam it onto the table.
Mm-hmm.
How many loaves of bread are you making these days?
Well, it seems to be going up and up. I think I'm making right now about 2,000 a week. That might be a little bit high.
And that's just after a couple of months of selling it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very impressive. What kinds of bread are you making?
Well, I'm making six different kinds. There's four that I have in the stores. My original bread that I started selling was the Blues bread.
What's the Blues bread?
What is it?
Yeah.
It's a cracked grains bread. It's got it's multi-grains. And it's got a covering of some pretty interesting seeds and such. And I put blue cornmeal on it. And I love the blues music, so I called it Blues Bread.
Very nice.
And that was the original one. And then I thought of, you know, the name Good Seed before I ever made the bread, you know, because I've been a bad seed, and now I feel like I'm a good one. So I named it Good Seed, and then I created a bread that would fit that. And I love the bread myself, and everybody else seems to, too. It's similar. A similar base to the blues, but there's no added fats except for the seeds. And of course, I use organic and or sustainable ingredients wherever possible. I also, the next bread I came up with was the nuts and grains bread, which is a richer bread, of course, because of the nuts and grains. And then I came up with a rock and rye bread.
Rock and rye rather than rock and roll. It's a rock
and
rye.
Yeah, sort of like that. Yeah.
And so I can kind of get what the rye part is, but what's the rock?
No, it just rocks. I just think the bread rocks.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's not just your average everyday rye bread. It's a rock and rye bread. That's what I meant to say. It's actually spelled R-O-C-K-I-N.
Oh,
apostrophe. With the apostrophe. Yeah.
Dave, your breads don't have ingredients with long words that I can't pronounce or spell. You're committed to certain things besides good taste.
Yeah, I don't use drugs in my bread, as I call them. I don't use drugs, period, and I don't
okay.
add them to my breads. I feel like I, you know, should make bread as natural and, you know, as righteous as possible.
Hey, you know, Dave, I need a loaf of bread today. Where can I get some?
Well, you can get it at New Seasons now.
Oh, good.
And Peoples. Peoples is a good place. Peoples Co-op.
That yeah.
Is. Food Front and Alberta Co-ops. And, of course, you can also get it at the Saturday Farmers Market.
Okay. I do have one other question about ingredients. So you use grain from Shepherd's Grain.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that outfit?
Yeah, well, they're a group of farmers that are committed to sustainable agriculture, which is direct seeding and reusing what's there and using as few chemicals as possible. Each successive crop is actually more and more natural. And
so they're not yet certified organic, but
no. They
would fit most definitions of sustainable.
It fits, to me, it fits the organic lifestyle and what we're looking for. It's not perfect, and neither is organic agriculture. And I think that at some point those two will meet, and that'll be perfect.
Mm-hmm. For the listeners, Shepherd's Grain is also the supplier for the dough for Hot Lips Pizza, which we've talked about on the show before.
And they also now have a booth at the Saturday Farmers Market in Portland where you can purchase any amount you'd care to.
It's about as local as you can get for the kind of wheat that we're getting from them, the wheat and wheat products.
Mm-hmm.
It's about as local because it's Columbia Plateau raised.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it fairly local.
That's Northwest anyway.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, we want to thank you very much for coming on KBOO, and it was short notice, and we appreciate your flexibility, and I know you want to get back into the bakery. We don't want anything to be overdone this morning.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bruce and I went to three restaurants that serve crepes. Crepes are a thin, unleavened pancake that are cooked on a shallow pan and folded over a filling of some kind. They are French originally. The word crepe comes from the Latin for curled, wavy, and that refers to the curling of the edges that dries during cooking because they are so flat and so thin that around the edges they do get a little dry. But then you fold them over these lovely fillings and you don't even notice that dryness. In France, the milk in the crepe batter is sometimes partly replaced with beer and wheat flour with buckwheat, especially in Brittany. Now, we visited three restaurants, and all three of them served a buckwheat crepe.
More than one. Just like Americans can put anything between two slices of bread, I guess the French, with their crepes, you can put anything in between two of these thin layers, and there are ones with traditionally breakfast foods, and there are ones with traditionally dinner foods. You can even get meats. Chicken was on the menu. And then there are sweet ones, dessert-type foods.
And some of them, you can actually have them just plain.
The menus in all three restaurants had two sections, savory and sweet. And we tried to have at least one of each in each restaurant.
And the savory was the one that had the buckwheat pancake.
In all cases, yes. Buckwheat and actually a mixture of buckwheat and white wheat. And then the sweet ones just had wheat in the flour.
Right, and they were more eggy, the sweet ones. So let's talk about these three restaurants. We went to a restaurant on Northeast Alberta named Fold. Now, Fold, I love their kitchen. They cook in a streamliner.
A travel trailer.
Travel trailer.
Which is parked behind basically a two-car garage, which is not quite tall enough for the trailer, but the garage faces the street, and the garage is the dining room with the front door open and a few tables between the front of the garage and the sidewalk. We were there on a nice day, and we sat outside.
We were able to watch them make the crepes. They had two nice, good-sized grills. I'd say they were at least a foot in diameter, maybe more, maybe 12, maybe 14 or 15 inches, and they just made them as they were ordered. I had a spinach pesto crepe. And Bruce, you had the Nutella?
Nutella, which is a bottled product. All three places include this, offer this in some of their crepes. It's a bottled product, which is sort of a crushed peanuts and peanut sauce and cocoa sauce and a few other ingredients. But peanuts and chocolate are the main ingredients.
And yours had raspberry and lime.
Yes.
It was nice and sweet. My spinach pesto one had a white sauce with lime and jack cheese. I liked it a lot. I liked that it had the buckwheat flour had a nice texture to it. They use whole grains there. Fold chooses to use whole, organic, local, and artisan ingredients when available. And I appreciate that.
I do, too, and the ingredients were definitely fresh. The raspberries were, and they should be at this time of year. And all the ingredients were good, and they worked well together, even the dough. It wasn't necessarily about the ingredients in between. It was about the dough also. And I haven't had a whole lot of buckwheat in my life, but I enjoyed this. You know, it was something on its own to taste and enjoy. And the texture on all this. Texture can go wrong, and I'll tell you about that from one of the other restaurants in a moment. But the texture, things were, there's a certain bite to it, not chewy, but a bit of a bite to it, which was good.
Our second restaurant was, can you pronounce that?
Chez Machin.
M-A-C-H-I-N. Chez Machin.
Think of the word machine without the E.
We ordered three crepes and split them. We had one... what do we call that? The savory one? That's the buckwheat. Okay, and that was, oh boy, am I going to say this right in French? Jambon, fromage, ouf, forget it, ham, cheese, fried egg, scallions, and fresh cream.
And the fried egg was on top. Everything else was inside.
And then we had two of the sweet dessert types. We had an apricot jam, chocolate, and toasted almond, and also a fresh mixed berries with homemade custard. And I liked them very much, although I found the texture a little more, it was a little tougher. It wasn't as delicate.
Just a little, and I think when you're dealing with something this thin, it doesn't take much time or just the slightest miscalculation in the thickness of the batter to make a real difference in what the commercial people call mouthfeel.
Yeah, so the mouthfeel was, in my opinion, was preferable at fold, but the fillings were still just absolutely delicious, and I had no problem enjoying both of those places.
The apricot was a jam, and that's what the menu said. It's just a little early yet for local fresh apricots, so no argument there. And the berry mix had raspberries, blackberries, and strawberries cut up to just the right size. It did not turn into a soupy mess like many pies will. This stuff was fresh and crisp and sweet, but naturally sweet.
Yeah, because the homemade custard kind of gave it a nice accompaniment. It wasn't overly sweet. It wasn't overly wet. But it's just right. It was very nice. What can I say? It was good stuff.
It was.
I'm going to do it again.
All right. Well,
you did do it again.
I went out again and went to Le Happy, which is on Northwest 16th and Lovejoy in Portland. And this is the oldest of the three restaurants. It's been there probably 5 years. I had two crepes. I had what they call a savory one. Le Happy called this their faux vegan. It had spinach, a crimini mushroom sauce, creme fraiche, fresh cream, and all of the sweet ones, and some of the others actually at the various restaurants had this as a thin white cream sauce. This also had goat cheese. This was kind of a runny mess, actually. The crimini mushroom sauce, there was too much liquid, and it caused the bottom part of the folded crepe to kind of fall apart, actually. If they wanted a mushroom one, they might have done better with a big chunk of portobello mushroom or something like that, and forget the sauce aspect. And the buckwheat crepe was the least enjoyable of the ones that I had. Now, they did say on the menu they used buckwheat flour, white wheat flour, water, eggs, milk, and a touch of sea salt. And it must have been only a touch because I couldn't taste it. For my sweet crepe at Le Happy, I had a citron strawberry. Citron is lemon. In this case, lemon curd. They had fresh strawberries, but unfortunately, they must have been shipped a long way. These were hard strawberries. The inside was white. They wasn't preserved. They were fresh, but I think they might have been getting these from California or something. And there's really no need to do that here in Oregon in July and August. The flour for this one was white wheat flour, water, eggs, milk, sugar, and vanilla. And I tried real hard and could not taste the vanilla. Sorry. Le Happy does have one option that the others don't have, which is that you can design your own, just as you can design your own pizza in many pizzerias. And there are quite a few ingredients, probably all the ingredients in the pre-designed crepes, and maybe even a few others. Prices, by the way, at all these places ranged from $4.50 to $8. The sweet ones tended to be less. I believe all the restaurants offered wine and salads, and Le Happy also has one form of steak. Their hours vary. Fold is open Saturday and Sunday only from 9 to 3, and their address is 2921 Northeast Alberta. Chez Machin at 3553 Southeast Hawthorne is open 9 to 9, and Le Happy, which is at 1011 Northwest 16th at Lovejoy, doesn't open till 6 p.m., but they're open until 1 a.m., and on the weekends they're open till 2:30 a.m.
Now, we've talked about the food there. How about the setting? Now, Fold was in that lovely two-car garage that I particularly liked. It had nice art on the walls, and it's sort of a funky, pleasant place to be.
But while we were sitting out there on Alberta, the bus went by, you know.
Several times. And for those of you who like to sit on the sidewalk and dine al fresco and are used to buses, it was probably no worse than anywhere else.
And loud music. They had loud music there, too.
The music was a little echoey in the two-car garage. You have to think about the acoustics in a place like that, I guess. It wasn't as loud as some restaurants. Chez Machin.
We were on a covered deck in the back.
Right. We walked through the front restaurant into the back, and there was an area which had four walls and a floor and a roof, but part of one of the walls didn't go all the way up. So it was sort of open air, but you didn't have to be bothered by the outside. And that was the place where we were able to feel undisturbed by outside influences, and we could concentrate on our food or conversation.
Yes, and the seating was more comfortable there also, I felt. And how about Lahapi? I didn't get a chance to go there.
Well, Lahapi is pretty much on the shoulder of a freeway. Northwest 16th is a one-way street, if folks know it, right next to and below Interstate 405. If you really like noise, you can sit on their sidewalk at the sidewalk tables. Inside the restaurant, the music was going. It was not hard to have a conversation there. Again, kind of funky art on the walls.
Casual dining at its finest.
Okay, full disclosure here. We actually recorded that review ahead of time, and since then I've been to yet another restaurant for crepes. This one is Vivace in Northwest Portland, and for me, it turned out to be the best of all. I had a buckwheat crepe with spinach, mushrooms, which tasted like shiitakes. They definitely weren't those bland button mushrooms. It also had slices of tomato and mozzarella cheese. All the ingredients came out well. The tomato was a little firm, but that kept it from liquefying and making a mess. This was the largest crepe I had anywhere, both in the quantity of fillings and the size of the crepe itself. I also had one with cinnamon, butter, and sugar. The butter was in the batter, and it was subtle. The cinnamon was liquefied inside, and the sugar was powdered over the top. It was very good and was the lowest priced of all at $3.50. Vivace bills itself as a coffee house more than the others we went to. It's in a Victorian house at the corner of Northwest 23rd and Pettigrove. There are three indoor and two outdoor seating areas, so you have your choice, and they were playing some pretty good world music. If you've never had crepes, give them a try.
Thank you, Bruce and Kate. We're going to go next to a piece with Bruce and Kate, once again, who spoke with local cheese artisans at the Portland Farmers Market on a recent Saturday afternoon.
We are talking about cheese today.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us who you are and about your cheese?
This is Juniper Grove Farms, and we have farmstead goat cheese. We raise all of our own animals, and most of our cheeses are made with unpasteurized goat's milk. They're cellar aged. I've got soft ripened cheeses and aged cheeses, some fresh cheeses.
I buy it every week. What's your favorite?
Well, I have a lot of favorites. The Tumalo Tum is wonderful for sandwiches and just for eating slices with like an apple. The Dutchman's Flat is a fabulous dessert cheese. And I use the Fromage Blanc for spreading on a bagel.
I'm here for cheese.
I'm with the Roe Creamery. We're most famous for the blue cheeses. We're the first blue cheese on the West Coast and the first blue cheese in America to win Best Blue Cheese in the World. Also do 20 different flavors of cheddars, three jacks, cheese curds, and butter. And it's all from organic, sustainable cow milk. Ed Bella, who's the founder of it, he's considered the godfather of artisan cheese making. He still comes up and checks on the recipe and everything.
This is Oregon Gourmet Cheeses. They're produced in Albany, just a little south of here. Brian Richter is the cheesemeister. We have a great camembert. We have a raw and a pasteurized. We have fromage blanc,
in a pesto and a dill and garlic and a plain, and I'm trying out two new flavors to see if everybody likes them. One is chipotle, and the other is a garlic and chive. The hard cheeses are Sublimity, they're a French-style wash-drying cheese. One is plain. One is Herbes de Provence, which is lavender, sage, and rosemary. And one is a whole black peppercorn.
Do you want to try a little today?
Thank you.
Sure.
I love it. So I'm Aaron. I'm selling cheese for Willamette Valley Cheese Company based out of Salem, Oregon. But we make cooked curd Dutch-style cheeses from our herd of 100 Jersey cows down there, which, as everyone knows, have the highest quantity of butterfat. So we make really great, fatty, delicious cheeses. We have Havartis and some different flavors of Havarti, including horseradish, Herbes de Provence, jalapeno, dill, chipotle, and garlic pepper. We have a cooking mozzarella, our Brindisi Fontina, the young Gouda, aged Gouda, the Born Cost raw milk aged Gouda, the caraway Gouda, the Jack, and the jalapeno Jack.
Blue Ribbon Cheeses. Tell us about the Blue Ribbons.
For the Wisconsin Cheese Show in 2005, we won for our class for our Fontina cheese. And then we also won some awards for our aged Goudas and the caraway aged Gouda in the American Cheese Society Show for 2005 just a few weeks ago.
I'm Joan Montillier, and my husband Pierre-Louis and I run a Grade A dairy and sheep and goat cheese facility in Dayton, Washington.
Is that unusual to be making cheese from two different animals?
We tried to find sheep 4 years ago to just do a sheep milk because my husband's from the Roquefort area of France, and it was so hard to find milking sheep that we could afford. So we started with half and half. And it ends up we love our goats so much that now I couldn't live without them. So we've got both. And the farm is open. It's a destination for all kinds of cheese lovers. We're open every weekend from 1 to 6. My husband's home pasteurizing today, and I'm down here during the market. And just come on up. We're having fun here. We're just 4 years into production. What we're doing is a hand-ladled traditional French-style cheese, which once the curd is set, you ladle with a big sieve called a pelle à brie, and you actually ladle into molds.
Are your cheeses sold in any other stores?
In Portland, I'm just going to Curds and Whey for the first time today after market.
I'm Brega Farm. It's in Sweet Home, Oregon. And we have a variety of fresh goat cheeses today. We have a few different varieties of Chev and our farmhouse, which is similar to a feta, but it's not aged, so it's a little milder. And then we have a Gozzarella, which is similar to mozzarella in texture, but it's a goat cheese. Yeah, and I've been working with the goats for about a week now and learning how to milk and learning how to make cheese and working with Jan and Larry. She does the aged cheeses more often in the winter, so they take up space during the process of aging. It's been a lot of fun.
How many goats in the herd?
They have 4 bucks and 30-odd milkers at the moment.
This is from Norris Farms. We are in Salem, south of Salem, and we make raw milk cheeses. We have our own dairy. We do the whole process from the cow to processing to distribution. And we have mild, medium, sharp, all kind of flavored cheeses. We also starting doing mozzarella, and it's all certified organic. We have about 400 cows altogether. They are outside, they are pasture fed all year long. They are really happy cows.
Well, you may be wondering where our cheese guys are, Justin and Stewie. We hope they'll be back next month, but we tried, the rest of us tried to make do in our
efforts,
our amateurish efforts. We are not experts on cheese.
Yeah,
however,
but those folks who are vending their cheeses at the farmers market are in fact experts, in
absolutely.
My opinion.
World class.
Yeah.
Okay, something entirely different now. Bob Hale grows onions near Hermiston. While he works in the field, he can prop open a laptop and read his email, or with just a keystroke, he can check the moisture of his crops as the jackrabbits run by. He can watch CNN online, he can play a video game, or turn his irrigation sprinklers on and off, all from the air-conditioned comfort of his truck, while cities around the country are battling over plans to offer free or cheap internet access. Bob Hale's Lonely Terrain is served by what is billed as the world's largest Wi-Fi hotspot, a wireless cloud that stretches over 700 square miles of dry landscape. An entrepreneur who wanted to sell communication services to local businesses and government approached Hale, who agreed and also became a user. Hale's onion empire supplies over two-thirds of the red onions used by the Subway sandwich chain, which is the largest food franchise chain in the country, even more than McDonald's or Starbucks, and they've gone to red onions recently. While local governments are using the cloud to check on parking meters, Hale, who can't get DSL where he is, says he can take a picture of one of his onions, plug it into his laptop, and send it to the Subway buyers in Subway franchise buyers in San Diego and say, here's a picture of my crop.
That's great. We have some cheese to taste that we were wonderfully given by some of the artisans at the farmers market. Let's see, we have three different kinds here. We have Oregonzola, that is from the Rogue Creamery, an artisan-made Gorgonzola-style cheese. We also have another from the Rogue Creamery, Oregon Blue Vein cheese. And we have from the... do you know who this Dale Havarti is from?
It's from Food Front, which has a nice cheese selection, mm-hmm. and just had their own label on. So I don't know where it's from, except that it's a Danish. Havarti with mm-hmm. dill.
And we were thinking we didn't come prepared with any of Dave's bread. Mm-hmm. So we're,
how foolish
I thought it was very silly. Kate, what did you think of the Oregonzola?
You know, I missed breakfast this morning, so I think they were all great. I don't know what to tell you. They're all good. And you know, it's not a very broad sampling. We have these cheeses because, well, one Bruce got over the weekend, I guess, that was left from something, another event, and the other two cheeses were given to us when we made that piece, and you know, we didn't ask for them; they were offered. So that's why we have them, and that's why we don't have a very broad selection. But they're all wonderful.
Yeah, I find that the Oregon. Now, again, I'm no expert, but both the Oregonzola and the Blue Vein are pretty salty for me.
Yeah. That's kind of typical of the blue cheese, but all of them are very rich in flavor, and we got them at the perfect temperature, too, because we mm-hmm. didn't get them right out of them. We had them out this morning.
Yeah.
I thought the Blue Vein from the Rogue Creamery, it kind of had a sort of a toasted sesame flavor, and it was very rich, somewhat of that toasted nut. And then in comparison, the Oregonzola was a little bit lighter and almost fruitier, and I don't know if those are, proper cheese terms, but you can tell when there's something a little lighter about something,
yeah, this is
or
probably
heavier
where we need our
or salty. I know.
Experience.
Where are they?
And also, before we go leave today, I'd like to let you know that if you tuned in today to hear John Koroloff talk about the benefits of a vegetarian diet, well, he didn't appear. So I'm sorry if that disappointed you, and I hope you were able to enjoy all the pieces that we did run today on the food show, and the cheese is great.
It's awesome. Yummy.
Also, want to mention real quick that if you remember last year, we went to the Oregon Food Fight. It's going to happen again this year on November 11th. If you've got a recipe or a product that you want to get rich on, go Google the words Food Fight and Oregon, and you'll find access information.
And it's also Oregon Food Bank, or Worldwide Food Bank Week,
National Food Bank Week.
This week. So the Oregon Food Bank has been distributing tons and tons, and you know, support them, and just so you know.
What's this music we're going out with?
Oh, it's a Three-Legged Torso, and it was very fortunate that they happened to be playing at the farmer's market the day Bruce and I were there to talk with the cheese vendors, and so I decided that we should listen to them on our way out today.
Thank you very much for joining us on the food show. Thanks, Kate and Bruce. And thank you to Tammy as well, our very flexible, illustrious engineer. And we look forward to seeing you the next third Monday of the month.
And thanks to the cheese vendors,
yes.
And thanks for this cheese sampling.
And all of our guests.
Bye now.
about 10 o'clock. You are tuned to KBOO Portland Community Radio at its very best. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Food Front Cooperative Grocery, specializing in foods from local and organic producers. Food Front is located in Northwest Portland at 24th and Northwest Thurman. For more information, the number there is 503-222-5658. Also by Radio Cab. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The upcoming program is brought is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net. And the upcoming program is Democracy Now!, today featuring an Iraqi feminist who comments on this weekend's vote on the proposed constitution, also an interview with author and social critic Barbara Ehrenreich.